Hello and welcome to Mondays on Tuesdays podcast, the podcast where nothing happens on time. I ramble about my uneducated musings of the economy and talk a bit about, I don't know, I guess honestly, I'm talking about things that I want people to say to me, such as, it's all right. I think that so lately I was talking to my romantic partner about how I feel like I actually have a lot of confidence problems and self-doubt, self-esteem issues, and they were like, "What? You?" And there's a really interesting difference between the way I present myself and the way I feel internally, 'cause hey, I'm human. That's what humans do. But what's interesting is I have so much faith in my what I call my operational perception, meaning how things work, machines, cars, situations. And I've had so many times in the past where I have said something about a situation or understood the sort of mechanics of where things were going and been right in a room full of people who said absolutely not, that I have tons and tons of confidence in the sense that I can sit in a room and say, "Hey, this is the deal," and people, everyone in the room can say no, and I can. I won't budge. And so people perceive that as confidence, but I like the confidence that I matter, and I like the confidence that anyone believe in me. And I got to thinking about this, and I think it's fair to say that in America today, a lot of people are considering this question of, are we a good country? And more importantly, am I a good person? Are they a good person? And that's a really hard thing to sit with. The things that have happened in the last 40 years, what have I done? Have I been complicit? Have I helped? And I think the best model to evaluate this is firstly, I believe all humans are a mixture of good and bad. There's no a good person, a bad person. And one of the things that I kind of come back to is the idea of campground rules, the sort of, leave it better than you found it. I think it's how we manage the good and bad in us that defines whether or not our lives get better, whether or not the world around us is a better place, whether or not we navigate situations. So the subject of this podcast is anti-violence. And that's different than non-violence, because non-violence to me is just like not participating in violence, but anti-violence is actually dissolving violence in yourself and around you to the extent that we have more peace and good times, basically. And it all comes back to a phrase that I encountered when I was studying the martial art of Aikido as a teenager. And Aikido is considered a nonviolent martial art, which is kind of an oxymoron up there with jumbo shrimp. But the reason is that it's all about basically pinning something to someone to the ground is the end game. There's no practicing how to punch and kick effectively. It's all navigating a violent situation into a non-violent situation. We would, throw each other across the room. We actually would practice laying on the floor, holding our heads up for, 5, 10 minutes at a time to make sure your neck muscles are strong so you don't hit your head when your sparring partner throws you across the room. And we would pair up and someone would, go to punch you and you would move out of the way and then move them off balance and onto the ground using tendons that are cause non-permanent damage, but enough discomfort or pain to take control of the situation. And my instructor, the sensei, said something one day. He said, "Violence is the last resort of the incompetent." And I thought about that. And I've thought about it since. And it's true. I mean, people, when they don't get their way, they become violent. But there's a really interesting interpretation of this underneath, which is, does that mean that competence is anti-violence? That if people had the ability to get things or the ability to negotiate or the ability to communicate their needs, they could get things without violence, and that violence is what people use when they either don't have confidence or don't care about even getting confidence. They just want to take stuff. So we'll talk a lot more about that after the break. I think it's been interesting lately to realize the number of ways in which, on a personal level, I don't have what I want, and I'm also not acting in a way that seems to change anything to get me to a different place. And the most massive realization for me earlier in the year, as I really began to rely on restaurants fully for my income, was the idea that economics has essentially two sides to it. One is something is created through some transformative action of some kind, and the second is someone pays for it. And in the middle of that, there's a sales process. There's a, storefront venue that people know to come to when they want that kind of thing, when they want that kind of food or want to buy that kind of thing, or they book an appointment with a manufacturer to go visit their facilities or review their products. And so production and distribution are completely separate because you could make a bunch of stuff that's awesome that nobody needs or wants, and it doesn't, that's not business. And also, you can sell a bunch of stuff that people don't really need, or they're buying from you only because they can't get it from somewhere else. And in my opinion, that's also not business. So it's this magic of production distribution. Demand flows downstream, production flows upstream, if you consider that upstream is the creation and downstream is the sort of request and acquiring of things and services. And so there's obviously many, many ways to play this game, many, many ways to play this business game. And I want to call attention to the idea of that idea of playing a game. And the reason that I'll make a prediction that it's not a word salad, but it's tr the wording's tricky, and I'll explain what I mean by this. But the revolution will not be violent. That's the phrase. The revolution will not be violent. Whatever problems we see in America, they will be resolved through nonviolence, which I've defined before the break as quite literally competence. People having the option to do something, people having the option to provide something for themselves, learn something for themselves. And then when people are satisfied, there will be less violence. Now, here's the reason why the revolution will not be violent, because that wouldn't be a revolution. That would be a continuation that changes hands. And you can see this in history. If you study violent coups, the decrease in violence doesn't actually happen after the coup. It happens much, 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 much later when the coup is exhausted, and eventually there is finally a nonviolent transition to nonviolence. And that's because violence begets violence. And I'll tell a real story that's sad, amazing because the person I'm talking about survived, but they were in a bar fight. Somebody was being unfair. They didn't even really know these people. And they stepped in and said, "Hey, stop treating this person badly," and then got in a fight with four people and won the fight. Hey, superstar, macho man, beat people up, cool. And then they were stabbed in the back like 11 or 12 times a few weeks later. And they survived. But it just goes to show that violence is a game you can win while you lose, right? Because generally, if you're someone who engages in what I call temporary violence, which is violence to get someone out of your way, you want to get on with your day. You want to go back to doing better things than getting in fights. But if you win that fight, the person you won it with wants nothing more than a rematch. So it's this situation where winning in violence basically just signs you up for the next chapter. It doesn't change things. And the question should be asked, well, if someone is attacking you, what do? You can't nonviolently defend yourself. That is true. But ultimately, it's nonviolence, and I just find anti-violence as the introduction of competency that ultimately revolutionizes, right? So the phrase "the revolution will not be violent" doesn't necessarily mean that, sadly, in America, because we are such a violent country, we won't see violence. It means that ultimately, when things get better, it will because they were changed in a nonviolent way. So competency as nonviolence, let's have a look at that. So if people have the ability to leave a job they don't like and find a job they do, they are less likely to undercut, destroy their fellow coworkers' reputation so that they can get a promotion. They're more likely to support their coworkers who may get promoted ahead of them. Whereas if they're stuck, if they have no options, if they don't have the competency to develop skills and believe their skills matter, they must engage in the destruction of their fellow coworkers' careers, maybe by withholding information, maybe by creating political controversies. And I would say this is a type of workplace violence where you are actually attacking the reputation of the people around you rather than building the business or competing fairly with skills. And so this idea of competence being anti-violence basically comes down to this idea that the only way we can build each other up, the only way we can come together as a country to solve problems is actually through the development of skills and the nurturing of who we are. And I went back to this thing that I started with, which is, people are neither good or bad. And this next bit might get more than a little weird, which is, do you consider yourself above other people and do you believe in democracy? Fairly simple question, but it's going to get very unsimple very fast. So, do you consider yourself above other people? Is this weird concept of obviously we're not all the same. Obviously, some of us are better or worse at other things. Now, let's take this metaphor quickly because it is so sensitive to the realm of cars, right? Cars drive, cool. But what kind of car would not be allowed to drive on the road? A car that's dangerous or does not meet the highway safety guidelines of being able to communicate safely with other cars. If the blinkers are broken, if the headlights don't work, if there's that thing where like the headlight that works is the one that's, on the side of the car that's by the shoulder. In the US, that's the right side. In the UK, that's the left side. And so you're driving down at night, and people don't know if you're a motorcycle. And the part of that they don't know is the part hanging out, and they might run into you. This is dangerous. And so we say, no, that car can't be on the road. The rules of the road apply to everyone, assuming you're a safe car. And I think a lot of people have that same model about people. The rules of society should apply equally to everyone, unless you're an unsafe person, meaning, if you're clearly a violent criminal, we put you in jail. You don't get the same rights. We take away your right to vote, which is somewhat sensible, but then it becomes kind of crazy because that's a very easy way to engage in kind of like behind the scenes gerrymandering where you try to convict a neighborhood of criminality just to, suppress their vote. So there are really weird edge cases, but the premise is, are you above other people? Kind of moves into this realm of the rules of the road, the traffic laws apply equally to all cars that are safe enough to drive. So, if you define that you're not above other people that are safe, then it quickly becomes, except for those people. It's almost impossible not to begin slicing up society this way. But the phrase, do you believe you're better or worse than other people, usually comes down to your faults. Do you admit you have faults? Other people have faults. And I think what I find comfort in is the idea that on top of these like moral, ethical humans that we think we are essentially survivalist creatures under the hood. And I believe deeply that if someone is desperate enough, all of the moral and ethics they have become very quickly overwhelmed. If you put a plate of food in front of someone who is very, very hungry and you say, you really should not eat this food, and maybe there's a good reason for them not to eat it. At a certain point, they are going to because they are a creature who needs to eat. And I think the same thing is true in that job situation I talked about. If someone wants to be decent and give chances to the people around them, but then all of a sudden they realize, you know what, there's no opportunity for career advancement if I don't undercut other people. The pressure will speak louder than that person's ethics, no matter what those ethics are. And that's why I say competence is the answer to violence. Competence is the way of anti-violence, is because desperation does things to people that is outside of society's control and outside of that person's control. And so now for the weird part. Are you better or worse than people who make more money than you? Are you better or worse than people who make less money than you? Are you better or worse than people that are homeless? Are you better or worse than people who have committed violent crimes? Are you better or worse than some of the people who have committed massive murders and genocides that you can read about in history? And I'm guessing that at some point in this list that I'm, sorry, not so unaccusingly throwing in your face, you're going to say, well, I am better than those people. And I'm not going to say that I'm better than you if you said that, because I would say I'm not better than any of those people. I'm not going to say that. The interpretation is there, but here's the thing. I do genuinely believe that people commit violent crimes. Sometimes people are unhoused from of their own doing. A lot of times it's situational. They had a disability claim they couldn't satisfy. They lost enough work that they lost their job, and then once they lost their job, they lost their ability to do laundry. Nobody would hire them, and it really is a sort of snowball thing. But back to the violent criminals, I think that some people don't actually know when to stop themselves, but a lot of people are driven to do things that they wouldn't do if they were able to be in different circumstances. And there's this really, really interesting story. Speaking of, dictators who've done like horrible things, supposedly there was a time in Vienna where Freud and Stalin and Hitler were all in Vienna at the same time, and they were all in similar intellectual circles, and it's likely that they were all at the same coffee shops. It's very likely that they met. There's no documentation of this, but those three people went on to do absolutely horrible things. Now, let's have just a quick look at some of the stories of what Hitler's life was like in Vienna. I'm not a huge fan of Hitler stories, but I find this one really interesting. So he was trying to sell artwork. He was like a failed artist. And that creates such a desperation in someone. And then when World War I broke out, he went to the German military and was rejected because supposedly like he was too skinny or something like that. And then he ended up in the Austrian military of World War I. And just towards the end of the war, there was a gas attack, and he ended up in the hospital blind for several weeks. And I don't think it's incidental that he began shaving his mustache into the iconic little like dots we see now. And I don't know if this is true, but I think it would be amazing if it was. The story was that he couldn't get his gas mask on because he had a big, like, poorly, like, cartoon villain mustache. And I just want to say, personally, I think villains are way cooler when they have twirly mustaches. I think all those pictures of Hitler with a twirly mustache would have been much cooler. Oh, what am I saying? What I'm trying to get at is that there's no reason to forgive people like Hitler and like all of these dictators who have done horrible crimes for what they've done. There's no reason for that. But it is worth understanding that the depravity and pain of that, I mean, that story is painful. He failed artist, he has this crazy identity thing with cutting his mustache from enormous physical pain that he's been in. And those are the kinds of things that make me feel like I am not above those people. And it's not super important to understand that the actions should be treated a different way. It's important to understand that the way out of the violence caused by desperation is actually competence. It's how do I balance my emotions so that I don't do the small things? I mean, cutting people off, not validating what they're saying. These are all very small acts of violence that, when magnified, become very large acts of violence, which is it's very different. Violence on different scales is very different. I'm not trying to say it's the same thing. But what I am trying to say is we have seen such a group of people who spew hatred coming to power in this country. And it looks like if you look at economics, there's been a tremendous, tremendous drive to control the economy, very much against the sort of liberty and freedom story in America that we've had. And when I look at the story of how the economy emerged and a potential explanation for why classical economics is so wrong so much and also so interested in capturing and extracting rather than transforming and building, I came to a really interesting conversation that Steve Keen was having with a host of a new wonderful podcast whose name escapes me, and I very much apologize for that. I'll put it in the show notes. And he was basically saying that, look, energy was the original form of the modern economy. So you start with a human physically can only exert a certain amount of energy, and then you move to animals. And it's the captivity of animals that provides wealth at this time. So you own so many horses, you can plow so many fields. There's a very violent owning and extracting model to the economy at that time. And then you move to burning fossil fuels, and it's the same thing. If you have the fossil fuel energy, you burn it, you have money. So the controllers of the economy were in a extract and control resources mode at that time. And then you move into the slavery period. And I think the question that's worth asking is how much of economic models are still based on this idea of ownership, control, and extraction? And if that's true, it makes sense that we have such a culture that seems to run on violence, seems to think that if you make things scary or painful enough, that is how they get better. Which is not true in a world of transformation where 70% of the economy is a service industry. But I am sort of starting to see why the economics of our time rely so much on force rather than innovation. Innovation isn't just something that companies give lip service to and then don't deliver, it's incompatible with the way they see economics. And I've been kicking this around for a while, this idea of competence being the answer. It's why I'm working on the Seneca system, is to bring competence to software in the form of flexibility and contextual consideration. I am this week the victim of an edge case. The restaurant that I'm at is switching login systems, and that's how we actually clock in and out, and that's how we get paid. I couldn't log in because there were two accounts associated with my account. And I talked to tech support, and it was one of those round and round things. And I know that this is because there has been a shallow approach to software that has resulted in these kinds of problems in any sort of minority case. There's just such a lack of caring about the whole system, or a lack of understanding that if you build something with depth, it has more transformative value. And I connect this, I hope I'm connecting it in this podcast effectively, but I connect this back to the idea that if business owners and business investors show up believing that they own a team of engineers that produces X productivity, and their job is to push them as hard as they can, that's a very violent perspective that does not involve the reality that the software process and all processes of business are tumultuous, and it is only with teamwork that you can actually have a good click and a good level of productivity. Why is that? It's because we don't live in the age of, managing animals to plow fields and, burning oil to deliver value. That's not the world we're in. I don't think the economics have caught up, and I also don't think society has caught up in this idea that it is competency and support and walking back from the desperation that actually has the key to value and solutions going forward. So I'm excited about this, and I hope I have done it justice. This is likely a topic I will revisit many, many times. It's so It's so big, I didn't really know how to put it out there, but I think back to that first phrase, violence is the last resort of the incompetence, and unwinding it into competence is the avenue of a nonviolent society. I think is a really beautiful thing. And I think more than beautiful, I think there's actually a realistic chance that this philosophy could form the backbone of whether or not humanity exists for a continued length of time. And I will see you next time.